This morning, we want to continue our study in John's Gospel. We are in chapter 7 of John's Gospel, and we're going to look particularly at verses 25 to 30 of that particular chapter. So, to introduce this, let me remind you that in John chapter 7, Jesus has gone to one of the major festivals of the Jews. This is a time when Israel would gather together to come to worship their God and to honor Him. It's called the Feast of Booths or the Feast of Tabernacles. They call it that because for a period of 8 days, the Jewish people would leave the comfort of their homes and live in temporary structures. If you were somebody who had to travel to Jerusalem, that was sort of your tent that you stayed in. If you had a nice, comfortable house in Jerusalem, what they often did is went up onto their roofs and built little booths out of sticks and things and spent 8 days out there. Why? Because they were remembering that the Lord brought them through the wilderness wandering for 40 years. And to go back into these booths or tabernacles was to remind them how God was faithful, even though they lived in less than ideal conditions. And so they would do this once a year because God commanded them to. And so it's the Feast of Booths. Now, on the timeline, we're about 6 months away from the crucifixion of Jesus. And the Feast of Booths was one of those times when the whole anticipation of the deliverer, the Messiah that God would send, was on the rise. In fact, at the Feast of Booths, they celebrated that someday Jerusalem would be reset in what they considered was its proper place, that it would sort of be the place from where all truth flowed, and it would be the place from where all life flowed. Streams of living water flowing forth, and the illumination of the whole world coming from Jerusalem. And so as they are there, people are thinking Messiah, they are talking Messiah, but for the last 2 years, 2.5 years, Jesus has been doing a public ministry, and people have been noticing because no one ever had a ministry like Jesus had. I think if we were to actually put a count on it, I would not be surprised to think that Jesus healed people in the thousands, if not tens of thousands. He cast out demons in the thousands, if not in the tens of thousands. He had the power to command nature and to stop storms. He had the power to call forth people back from the dead. And he preached and taught the word of God with the authority that could only come from the mouth of God. Jesus had been recognized. People wondered, was he coming to the Feast of Booths this year? And for halfway of the feast, the first 4 days, nobody saw him. But then he shows up at the middle of the feast, and sort of that murmuring crowd that was there. Remember, there's a lot of pilgrims at these festivals. Jerusalem has a couple hundred thousand people, which makes it a big city in its day. But you could easily increase that number by 5 to 10 times with the pilgrims. That's a big crowd, and one of the major questions in the minds of the crowd is he coming to the feast this year? Halfway through the feast, it looks like he will not show up, but sure enough, midway through, Jesus is in the temple, and he is teaching. And he is teaching with authority, and he is teaching with boldness. And the people must wonder, how is he getting away with this? Because they know that a death warrant has been issued for him. The people have two basic opinions about this Jesus. We know that some say he's a good man, and they're speaking practically. Anybody who heals diseases, casts out demons, and stands up to the corruption of the priests can't be bad. He must be a good man, but that's just a practical way of seeing it. Others, on the other hand, though, who are much more traditional would say, no, he's a deceiver because he leads the people astray. He does not hold to the teachings and the leadership of Judaism. And yet, this discussion, though it's all over the place, is not particularly open because we know that for fear of the Jews, people were sort of talking amongst themselves but not declaring things. And we know that the leaders very much wanted to intercept Jesus on the way to the feast so that they could dispose of him quietly. But that did not happen. For 4 days, Jesus will be at the feast. It's an 8-day feast. At the midway point, there he is in the temple, and he will start to proclaim the truth of God. And it's obvious that Jesus is defying the hostile authorities. And the fact that he's able to get away with this and continue to proclaim in the temple has to raise even more questions. such as, how is he getting away with this? That would have to be question number one. Secondly, what does this say about the Jewish leaders? Have they basically come to accept this Jesus and now endorse him if they're letting him speak on their turf? The temple was the Jewish leaders' turf. What does this say about Jesus himself? What type of authority does this man have? And remember, he is God the Son, sent by the Father. He is able to do things that no one else could, and even to stand up against the false authority of the leaders. Perhaps the biggest question and the most important question that's being asked is, who is this one? Is he actually the Christ? Folks, let me say, of all the questions that have been asked in all the ages and all the history of mankind, there's probably no more important question than that one. Who is Jesus? How do you understand him? Our passage for this morning is going to focus on the residents of Jerusalem. We've actually got different segments of the crowd that's gathered there. We've got, you know, you got Galileans and you've got Judeans and you've got the diaspora Jews. That's the ones who have kind of gone to various corners of the world, but they would come back for the big celebrations if they could. But particularly, we want to consider this morning, what did the residents of Jerusalem think about Jesus? Did they judge him to be the Christ or not? All right, let me read the passage for you. I'll give you the outline, and then we'll start going through it verse by verse. So we're in John chapter 7. I want to begin reading God's word at verse 25. So some of the people of Jerusalem were saying, "Is this not the man whom they are seeking to kill? Look, he's speaking publicly, and they are saying nothing to him. The rulers do not really know that this is the Christ, do they? However, we know where this man is from. But whenever the Christ may come, no one knows where he is from." Then Jesus cried out in the temple, teaching and saying, "You both know me and know where I am from, and I have not come of myself. But he who sent me is true, whom you do not know. I know him, and because I am from him, and he sent me." And so they were seeking to seize him, but no one laid his hand on him because his hour had not yet come. I've got 3 points this morning for our message from the first 3 verses. I want us to have a look at this supposed superiority of the Jerusalem opinion. There are opinions and then there are opinions, but whose opinion is really important? Which one really counts? So we're going to look at whether or not Jerusalem's opinion was all that superior. Verses 28 and 29 are the second point that Jesus is going to reveal the fundamental flaw in their reasoning. So the opinion is not all that superior, and Jesus reveals the flaw that causes it to be problematic. Last verse, verse 30, I want us to see that there is a sovereignty. The sovereignty of God that rules both those who seek and those who would seek to seize. Both seekers and seizers. And that's not Caesar like Caesar Augustus. That's guys we're trying to grab. Anyway, let's look at verse 25. So, some of the people of Jerusalem were saying, now, I told you there's a large crowd here at Jerusalem. In fact, Jerusalem as a city can in no way accommodate all of them. They were camping on all the hillsides around. 1 million people, up to 2 million people. It's huge, this gathering. And for at least 4 days before Jesus reveals himself in the temple, he's already been discussed by various groups. And so the Judeans are going to have an opinion. By the way, the Judeans are the land immediately around the city of Jerusalem. You know, they're basically farmers around that area. They would have had some crops. Some would have grown olives. Some would have grown grapes. A lot would have had sheep and goats. It's basically the surrounding area. They knew something about this Jesus because he had done some ministry in Judea, but not for a while. Why? Because there was a death warrant. They were seeking to kill him, we read back in chapter 6. But the Judeans would have had an opinion about Jesus. Then, of course, there are the Galileans, where Jesus had spent about the last year of his ministry, up towards the north. There was a large contingent of Jews up there, and they had a large community, and those Galileans, of course, had an opinion about Jesus. We know that there had been a good start to that following, but in chapter 6, verse 66, we're told that most of the Galileans had turned away, weren't following him anymore. Then, of course, there are the Jews from the far-flung corners of the world. These are the dispersion Jews, the diaspora Jews, they're called. Probably spoke Greek, but they were Jewish nonetheless. They would have come back for the celebration. They too would have soon heard about this great prophet, this miracle worker named Jesus. And so, as there are multiple opinions there, it's probably significant to say what value would have been assigned to each group's opinion. If you are the ones from the diaspora who've had the least exposure and contact with Jesus, your opinion is probably considered to be the least important. If you're from Galilee, well, Jesus was from Galilee, you might assume that he knows something. Then again, there was never a great deal of respect paid to Galilee. It's kind of like, you know, living in Mission when people live in West Vancouver. Our opinion doesn't hold much weight. Then, of course, there were the Judeans. But probably everybody would have probably recognized that the opinion that should have had the most value might have been from these people from Jerusalem. What would make Jerusalem's opinion so valuable? Well, number one, this is the group of people that is closest to the temple and to the leaders and to the great teachers and rabbis of Israel. This is probably a group of fairly educated people, and we tend to think that educated people have better opinions than uneducated people. They would have been directly tied to the temple functions. You have to understand the importance of Jerusalem to the Jewish people. That is the center of the world. And the center of Jerusalem, of course, is the temple. And the closer you are in proximity to Jerusalem and the temple, the more you should know. They would have been educated, probably. They would have been aware of the issues. Because when you live in the capital, and you're close to the sort of the heart and the soul of Judaism, whatever discussions you would have heard about, and they would have been aware of the influential positions, because certainly those who were priests and rabbis and scribes and Pharisees, they probably would have all shared their opinions, and I'm sure that an opinion about Jesus had been shared well many times. If you remember a little earlier when Jesus begins this ministry, he says, "Why are you trying to kill me?" And the response that comes back is, "You're demon-possessed. Nobody's trying to kill you." Well, that's one of the opinions that was shared about Jesus. How do you explain away his power? Well, yes, he has power and he does miracles, but these are the devil's miracles. Which always fascinates me, because I have never, ever perceived or read where the devil healed anybody, cast out any demons, did any acts of tremendous kindness, and spoke pure truth. Just doesn't happen. But anyway, here you have the people of Jerusalem, and they are saying, "Is this not the man whom they are seeking to kill?" Let's deal with the "they" first. Who's the "they" that they're referring to? Yeah, the Jewish religious leaders. Now, isn't it fascinating that a few verses earlier, when Jesus says, "Why are you trying to kill me?" the response that comes back out of the crowd is, "Nobody's trying to kill you, you have a demon." And yet here the people of Jerusalem speak as if this is common knowledge, because it was common knowledge. "Is this not the one they are seeking to kill?" Okay, well, Jesus is speaking truth, and obviously others are not. But they're kind of wondering what the leaders are doing at this point in time. Now, without a doubt, I would suggest that the majority of Jerusalem residents were rather loyal to those who controlled the temple. You have to think where the income for those who lived in Jerusalem basically came from. It's not really on an official trade route. It's off the trade route a little bit. It's not a hotbed of agriculture like Galilee is, where you can make a lot of money off of that. Really, the economic engine that drives Jerusalem is what? The temple. and the fact that Jews come to worship at the temple, and that there are at least three major feasts every year, plus other minor feasts, and it's all about the temple. And it's all about those who control the temple. So if you ever want to talk about a town that has a whole bunch of company people attached to it, those who live in Jerusalem are fairly loyal to the temple and to what drives the temple. It's the economic engine. It supports the populace. I would actually suggest to you this morning that this whole idea of messianic fervor, in other words, this excitement that Messiah is going to come, it probably was a little less in Jerusalem than it was in the surrounding areas. Why? Because in Jerusalem, a Messiah was going to upset the status quo. They already had it figured out. They had a deal worked out with the Romans. Now, this is ironic because the Jews always claimed that they wanted to throw the Romans out, but the ruling class of Jerusalem had such a cozy deal worked out with the Romans, they didn't want them to go. They were sort of the protection and the reason why they were able to continue to do all the things they did to make money. But the others, the pilgrims who would come to Jerusalem, those people from outside in Judea, from Galilee, from the ends of the earth, they were the ones who got all caught up in this messianic fervor. Yes, O Lord, come and deliver us from the Romans. I don't think the Jerusalemites wanted to be delivered from the Romans. It was a good deal they had. Fervor was an out of Jerusalem type of thing. But people would have looked to Jerusalem and they would have assumed that these were the people in the know. These were the people who had the best exposure. These were the people who were under the influence of the best leaders. Therefore, what they say should be true. Now, that's ironic when you stop and think about how Jesus assesses Jerusalem. In Luke chapter 13, verse 34, listen to what Jesus says. He says, O Jerusalem, the city that kills prophets and stones those who are sent to her. Is that a positive affirmation or a bit of a critical thing? That's pretty straight up. Jesus says, how often I have longed to gather you and to gather your children together like a hen gathers her chicks, but you will not have it. What Jesus says about Jerusalem is, you think you know better. In other words, you've heard of an inferiority complex. This is the polar opposite. This is a superiority complex. And you can easily accuse Jerusalem of doing that. Jerusalem thinks they know, and Jerusalem thinks that their opinion is better than everybody else, and that everybody else should be listening to their opinion. And so look at what they say. They begin by asking this question, and they're really wondering about their leaders. This is sort of a question with a little bit of a jab attached in it. You know, is this not the man whom they are seeking to kill? Then verse 26 begins with look or behold. Basically, they're really drawing some attention to this. Hey, he is speaking publicly. Where was Jesus doing his teaching? Now, when you talk about the temple, in the middle of the temple, there was the Holy of Holies where nobody could go into. Then there's the court of the priests. Then there's the court of the Jewish men. Then there's the court of the Jewish women. Then there's the court of the Gentiles. It kind of goes out in sort of concentric squares, not circles, but squares. It's a big complex by the time you get up to the court of the Gentiles. Jesus is standing somewhere in those public courts, but he is in the temple and he is teaching. Now, how does a man who has had a death warrant out over him for the better part of the last year stand for four continuous days in the temple and teach? It's got to tell you something. It certainly raises some questions in the minds of the citizens of Jerusalem. They say, look, he's speaking publicly, and they, again referring to the Jewish religious leaders, are saying nothing to him. Odd dynamic. A group who hates Jesus enough to want to murder him whenever they can get their hands on him, and yet he is standing in their midst on their turf teaching. And it's recognized by the Jerusalem citizens that they're doing nothing about him. Now, let me read for you the next phrase a little bit more literally from the original text. And it goes this way. A literal read would be, "Perhaps the rulers know the truth that this one is the Christ." We have a question mark there. It's actually not a question mark, it's a statement. Perhaps the rulers know the truth. Now, when you say that, what are you saying? You're basically implying that up until this point in time, the rulers have not followed the truth. But perhaps they know the truth now. And know the truth, by the way, is emphatic in this statement. The truth. And that this one is the Christ. You know, it's interesting. You would assume that people who are codependent upon each other, the way that the religious leaders are codependent upon the people of Jerusalem, and the people of Jerusalem are dependent upon the leaders, that there would be some basic respect. Codependence does not often breed respect. And in this case, they are kind of throwing down a bit of a challenge to their own rulers, saying, "Have you now concluded that this is the Christ?" All I can tell you is that the religious leaders who heard this type of statement coming out of the populace of Jerusalem must have been some upset. There was an inability to challenge Jesus. And the people of Jerusalem said, hey, maybe they've actually given him their grudging support. But look at verse 27. Remember, the rulers do not really know this, do they? Verse 27 says, but we know. There's a contrast here. There's a contrast in the word however, or it's a strong contrast. They're saying whatever the religious rulers are doing or not doing, and by the way, we often think that when somebody doesn't do something that they're actually approving it by their silence. But whatever they're doing or not doing, we know this, is what the populace of Jerusalem says. We know where this man is from. And you go, yeah, so? I'm from Winnipeg. What does that tell you? Tells me I usually lean over towards the east because I'm used to the wind blowing me from the west. Not much. They say, we know where this man is from. Basically, what they are saying is, we know whom this man is because we know where he is from. That settles it in our minds. We have a formed opinion that is correct and accurate on the basis of we know where he's from. We know this one. We know where he is from. All right. That's extreme confidence in the assertion that they're making. Again, they think that because they know where Jesus is from, they know him. By the way, where would they have said Jesus was from? I heard about four different answers there. Typically, where would people have said Jesus was from? He is Jesus the Nazarene, all right? So that's where they would have said he was from. Now, is that technically right? I got some nods, I got some shakes, I got some confused looks. That's okay. How old was Jesus when he moved to Nazareth? Probably closer to 3 years of age. Because remember, he starts off, he's born in Bethlehem. He's in Bethlehem for a number of months before the Magi come. Then they do the escape to where? Egypt. And he's there for a couple of years. Then he comes back and they settle at Nazareth. Technically, is he from Nazareth? No, I mean, that's where he spends some of his formative years, but that's not necessarily the case. So your argument would be, well, he obviously then is from Bethlehem. How many of you would say that Jesus is from Bethlehem? You'd be partially right. You say, partially right? Where else could he possibly be from? Yeah, who's Jesus? Let's just stop for a second here. You and I, depending on where we were born, technically we would say that's the city we are from. Why? Because we had no pre-existence. Jesus, who is God the Son, who leaves his place in heaven and is conceived in Mary, the Virgin, and is born in Bethlehem, though Jesus the Christ is born in Bethlehem, he pre-exists as God the Son. So actually, if you want to talk about where Jesus is from, by the way, do you notice that John's gospel keeps talking about, I was sent, I was sent, I was sent. It just comes up all over the place in this gospel. Why is that so important? Because Jesus is not just another person, another man. Jesus is both fully God and fully man. He is the pre-existent Son of God, and he is Christ incarnate. He's both. But it's interesting because they think they know where he's from, and by the deduction of where they think they know where he is from, they have basically rejected him here. Nope, can't be Messiah, can't be the Christ. Why? Because we know where he's from, and he's not from the right place. Now, what's the problem with Nazareth? Oh, there's lots of problems with Nazareth. You know what? There was a saying, yeah. Can anything good come out of Nazareth? That kind of tells you a little bit about the culture of Nazareth. It was a rotten, miserable place to grow up. When Jesus goes back there to preach, at one point they try to force him out onto a 1,000-foot cliff that's outside of Nazareth and throw him off. Nice, friendly town. You know the signs that go in front of towns? Welcome to Nazareth. We throw our most important ones off the cliff, is probably what it should say. Or we try to. Nothing good comes out of Nazareth, but more than that, Nazareth is in Galilee. Can anything good come out of Galilee? Well, there's another question. A little farther in this chapter, by the time we get into the verses 42 and beyond, you're going to see that the experts are going to make a statement and say that no prophet comes out of Galilee. Now, there are experts and there are experts. That sound funny? There are some experts that can only tell you the time after they've stolen your watch. Because really, they're not experts, they're just pretenders. The experts here in Jerusalem who say that there are no prophets who come out of Galilee are wrong. For there is one prophet who comes out of Galilee. Who comes out of Galilee? Very good. Jonah comes out of Galilee. Jonah grows up, according to 2 Kings 14, in a place called Gath Hepher. What a great name for a town. Where are you from? I'm Gath Hepher. Spell that. Yeah, I can just hear it now. Do you know where Gath Hepher is? About 3.5 kilometers from Nazareth. It is, you know, stone-throwing distance away. There is indeed a prophet who comes out of Galilee. But Jesus, though he is a prophet and probably fulfills the promise of the prophet from Deuteronomy chapter 18, he is more than that. I want you to go back to the idea that Jesus comes from Bethlehem. Who else declared that the Messiah would come from Bethlehem? Do you remember the story of Jesus' birth from Matthew's gospel? And we're in Matthew chapter 2, and wise men, magi, come from the east, and they go to Herod, and they say, "Where is the one who is born king of the Jews?" Now, Herod is not a scholar in Jewish knowledge or Old Testament, and so he calls together his court advisors and his theologians, and he says, "Where is Messiah supposed to be born?" Do they actually give him a definitive answer? Sure they do. And what is the definitive answer? The Messiah will be born in Bethlehem. And that's about 5 kilometers outside of Jerusalem. It's not a great distances away. Bethlehem, all right. Where does that come from? That's actually from the Old Testament, from one of the minor prophets, Micah. Very good. Micah chapter 5, verse 2. And if you've been at some Christmas programs, or you've heard some Christmas preaching, I hope you kind of know a little bit about the verse. Micah, I'm going to actually turn to it here so that I say it the right way. Micah chapter 5, verse 2. But you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, in other words, the Bethlehem from that particular region, though you are small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come for me, for God, one who will be ruler over Israel. Now, we probably are all somewhat familiar with that much of the verse. Typically, though, we stop quoting the verse at that point, and that's a big mistake. Don't ever quote half a verse of Scripture. Always go for a little context. Let me give you the rest of the verse here, and it's interesting. It talks about Bethlehem, though you're small, there's going to be a great one who will come from you. He will come forth for God. He will be ruler over all Israel. Now it talks about his origins, whose origins are of old. And so you're saying, well, that's because he comes from an old hometown. No. Go the last line here, and this is quite fascinating. My version reads, from ancient times, but I'll tell you this morning that if you're going to do a nice, clean, literal read off the Hebrew here, it actually says, whose origins are from old, from eternity, is what it says. Whoa. What does that mean? Messiah, though he does come from Bethlehem, where does he originate from? He originates from eternity. In other words, who lives in eternity? There's three persons. Father, Son, Holy Spirit are from eternity. The Messiah, according to Micah chapter 5, verse 2, will come from eternity. Now, isn't that fascinating? Because the critics of Jesus, these wise people from Jerusalem, who have formed this opinion about him saying that we know where he's from. Oh, no, you don't. But when the Christ may come, no one knows where he is from. Now, actually, that's right. Because which human being knows about eternity? Here, the Jerusalemites are right, even though they have no clue they're right, because who knows where he comes from? Well, Micah told us already that he comes from eternity. Problem was is that they were confident in dismissing Jesus as Messiah because they thought he came from Nazareth. You know, the Jerusalem opinion was so superior that it actually blinded them to the truth of who Jesus was. Again, there are so many aspects that testify to who Christ is. John chapter 5, the Father gave him works to do, and each one of these works testified to who he was. But they dismissed him on that one technicality that they thought he came from Nazareth. I want us to look at how Jesus is going to reveal this fundamental flaw in their reasoning. For he will have a response to these Jerusalemites, and he is going to reveal how they really should not have misunderstood him, but clearly they have. It says, then Jesus cried out in the temple. Now, wasn't he teaching up until this point? He is. Why all of a sudden are we turning up the volume here? Because that word cry out means to cry out with intensity and with volume. So he's been teaching in a normal voice, and all of a sudden, boom, now the voice is going forth. He cries out of the temple, and he's still teaching. And now he is saying, he's making a little adjustment in what he's saying. Look at what he says. And this is kind of, again, an interesting statement. And me, you know? You think you know me? And you know where I am from? Remember, here is the Jerusalem crowd who would have had influence over the other pilgrims who have come to this great feast. And if they're going to dismiss Jesus and saying, hey, he can't possibly be Messiah because he doesn't come from the right place, Jesus now needs to counter that falsehood that could lead people astray. And so what he says, you think you know me? You think you know where I'm from? He is about to challenge them. Because look at what Jesus says. I have not come of myself, but he who sent me is true. Remember, I'm telling you that all over John's gospel, the emphasis is on the one who sent Christ. Why? Because if God the Father didn't send Jesus, then why was Jesus there? Then he was there on his own initiative. Then he is kind of, you know, making this up as he goes along. But that's not the case. For he tells us so many times, John does in this gospel, that Jesus does nothing on his own initiative, that Jesus does exactly what the Father has told him, that Jesus obeys the will of the Father to the letter and to perfection. Jesus says, you think you know me and you think you know where I am from. But you know, there's a major problem in their logic. Have you noticed how John likes to make ironic statements, or we should say the Holy Spirit gives John some ironic statements to make during this thing? You know what an irony is? It's something that, you know, can't possibly be true, but it is true, and it kind of makes you shake your head a little bit. Stop for a second and just pull back on some bigger context here. Why are all these people at this feast? Are they not there to celebrate their loyalty to the one true God? Mm-hmm. And what are they doing? They are rejecting the Son of the one true God. How can this be true, but it's true? How can Jerusalem respond this way to the Christ? It's because he doesn't line up with their expectations. Oh, folks, here we have such a problem. There's not a person in this room that does not have a series of expectations about virtually everything. We want it this way. We want it this way. We expect it to be this way. We will believe it if it's this way. In this case, they have looked at Jesus and they have dismissed every evidence and every declaration that the Father has made about him. And they said, no, we don't accept him. We don't receive him. Wow. Have you ever heard the expression they wouldn't recognize someone if they stood right in front of them? Here's a group of people who are gathered at this great feast to worship and honor their God. And they wouldn't recognize God if he stood right in front of their faces, because he's standing right in front of their faces. This is God in the flesh. And if you don't recognize the flesh, you've got to recognize everything he says and does and who he is in his very person. He's so obvious. God did not make Jesus obscure. Jesus is the revelation of God, as it says in Hebrews chapter 1. He's the exact representation. In the last days, God has spoken to us through his Son. Here we are in God's city. We're at God's temple. We're supposedly with God's people. This is God's celebration. And here stands his Son in the flesh. And the residents of Jerusalem are saying, nope. Wow. What this tells us is a little bit about the sinful nature of mankind. Even the religious ones. Even the ones who were part of an old covenant like Israel was. You know what? The sinful nature of their souls, the sinful nature of their minds, the sinful nature of their will rejects the God-man sent to reconcile them to the heavenly Holy Father. Ladies and gentlemen, we should not be surprised, for as we read through the Old Testament, we see that this is the tragic reality that just exhibits itself over and over again. By the way, how did Jesus describe Jerusalem? You killer of prophets and the ones who stone everybody God sends to you. Wow. When we began our gospel, we read John 1:18. It said, no one has seen God at any time. The only begotten God who is in the bosom of the Father, this is talking about Jesus Christ, he has explained him. Here is Jesus, and he is revealing God the Father over and over again to a stubborn religious people who do not accept God for who he is. Jesus then will say, you know, the problem of these Jewish people was that you don't know the one who sent me. How can the populace of Jerusalem know God the Son if they don't know God the Father? They just have no frame of reference by which to assess these things. But when Jesus says, whom you do not know, he's basically telling them, we're at a feast for God in the city of God, at the temple of God, and you're supposed to be the people of God, and you don't know who God is. And I'm God. Jesus said, the only begotten God is in the bosom of the Father. He has explained him. Look what Jesus says in verse 29. I know him. Because I am from him. And he sent me. By the way, was Jesus confused about who he was? I know him. What is he saying? There is no other being in the universe that knows the Father the way the Son knows the Father. At the deepest and the clearest and the most profound level, Jesus knows the Father. I know him. Why was Jesus sent? Well, he was sent indeed to save a people for God, but he was also sent to reveal God so that people might know who God is. You want to know who God is? Who do you look to? You look to Jesus. He is the exact representation of the Holy God. I'm from him. He has sent me. It's tragic that the thinking of the citizens of Jerusalem was so flawed. But do you know why it was so flawed? Because unless you know God, all of your reasoning is off. All of your reasoning is off if you don't know God. Only Jesus can make God truly known. And he does this by making dead sinners alive in him. Without life in Christ, no one can know God. And let me tell you, no amount of education can make up for knowing God. And no amount of religious tradition can make up for knowing God. And no amount of personal effort can make up for knowing God. And no other supposed revelation will make up for knowing God. Do you remember chapter back, John 6? Peter utters those words, we have believed, and now we know. The idea of coming to God, of God calling you, of God helping you to believe in him, enabling you to believe, the fact that there has been a new start in your life, that the deadness is gone, that the breath of life has been breathed into you, that there is now regeneration and a start, and what was dead has now come to life, and you know God. From that point, understanding begins. Up until that point, you will never guess who God is. In fact, you will end up rejecting him just like these religious people did. The fundamental flaw in their reasoning was they thought they could recognize God without knowing God. No such thing. Last verse, and here we're going to look at sovereignty, because it's a sovereignty that rules both seekers and Caesars. Verse 30. So they were seeking. You know what? If we stopped there, it would be nice. Because you could say, hey, this is a good thing. They're seeking him. It doesn't stop there, though. And so they were seeking to seize him. Well, maybe that's in a positive sense, you know, a loving seize. No. What are they looking to do? They are acting on a violent impulse, because that word has great force attached to it. And what are they going to do with Jesus once they've seized him? They are going to turn him over to the ones who want to kill him. This is where you see the loyalties of Jerusalem. I said, they're a company town. They need to stay in lockstep with those who generate the income, the temple leaders. They are seeking to seize Jesus. In verse 27, they basically rejected him in their minds, but in verse 30, this is now a violent impulse. Now just back it up a little bit. First 4 days of the feast, everybody's wondering where Jesus is. Is he going to show? Midpoint of the feast, there's Jesus in the temple. He's preaching. The questions are being asked. Isn't this the one whom the leaders want to kill? He's speaking publicly. They're doing nothing. Now, all of a sudden, the populace of Jerusalem is going to do a favor for their leaders. And they think, if the leaders won't seize him, we will. So they were seeking to seize him. And no man laid his hand on him. Now, from a human perspective, if you've got, you know, dozens or hundreds of individuals who want to grab hold of somebody, what can possibly stop them? By the way, what stayed the hand of those who wished to seize Christ? The will of the Father. Remember, Jesus keeps talking about, and he's going to say again, no man laid his hand upon him. Why? Because his hour had not yet come. I don't know that we understand how scripted the life of Jesus really was. That the Father had an exacting timetable and that Jesus goes according to every detail on the timetable. As we get farther and farther into the gospel, especially John's gospel, we're going to see that this is fulfilled as prophecy. This, to minor little details, they're all being fulfilled as prophecy. Why? Because everything has to be done in the wisdom and the plan and the sovereignty of God from before the foundation of the earth. And Jesus will go just as the Father has decided it will be, but not in any other way. You might say to yourself, well, there was only maybe, you know, dozens or hundreds here that wanted to seize Jesus. What if the whole world wanted to seize Jesus? And all the power of the enemy and the devil himself, they all wanted to seize Jesus. Could they do it? There's a simple answer. No. Why? Because the power of God is greater. The sovereignty of God is absolute. The will of God cannot be broken. Here we have the case of Jerusalem, once again proving what Jesus will say, is that you are the killers of prophets and the ones who stone anybody sent to you. What do these guys want to do? They want to do physical harm and violence to Jesus and send him away to be killed. And yet, according to the Father's will, no one lays a hand on him. What is the restraining power of the will of God? It is complete. You see, the residents of this holy city, and of course we always joke and call lots of things holy cities. The residents of the holy city, being Jerusalem here, were seeking to suppress Jesus by force, and they were seeking to suppress his influence among the pilgrims who had gathered. And guess what? They could accomplish neither, for God's sovereignty was greater. Indeed, Jesus would be arrested 6 months from this point. Jesus would suffer and die upon the cross 6 months from this point, but he would die in perfect sync and in perfect accord with the Father's will and plan. You see, absolutely no one can override the sovereignty of God. His hour was still to come. In fact, if all the hostility in the universe ganged up against God, it's not enough. As you read through John's final letter, the Revelation, and you get into the final chapters, and you see the whole earth gathered together to fight against the Messiah and his people, it's not enough. It's never enough. Please don't have this false thinking. And I don't know where it creeps in from, but it creeps in that God and the devil are having this struggle and God is winning, but just by a little bit. I can't open my arms wide enough to tell you how far it goes. God never wins by a little bit. He's God. He's sovereign. His will shall be done. An impulsive mob could not take Jesus before his time. Conniving high priests could not stop Jesus before his time. Jealous Pharisees could not stop Jesus before his time. And Satan and all of his forces cannot stop Jesus before the will of the Father is complete. As John's gospel continues, we will see more and more the sovereignty of God at work. It's a beautiful picture that's presented for us. So as we close this morning, let me tell you that we not need to be very careful about where we get our ideas regarding who Jesus is. I know there's lots of opinions floating out there. And here I'm going to pick on one of my personal bugaboos here again. I like educational television. But there's a lot of so-called television that wants to talk to you, especially when we get to the Easter season, the Christmas season. And they're going to start talking to you about the historical Jesus, and they're going to start talking to you about all the things that all of the theologians and everybody else has come up with. Ladies and gentlemen, can I suggest that most of these people are like experts who have to steal your watch before they can tell you the time? These are not regenerate individuals. It doesn't take you too long to figure that out watching it. And they're telling you lies about Jesus. Do not let public opinion, even so-called informed opinion, influence you as to who Christ is. You want to know who Jesus is? You pick up the book. And it tells you clearly who Jesus is. Secondly, unless one is born of God, they really can't understand him. Now, I said before that there's sort of no understanding. Well, you would say, hey, but people have understanding in this world. I mean, they build wonderful machines, and they paint great pictures. They do all kinds of incredible things. I'm not saying that there's no understanding whatsoever, but an understanding of God only comes to those who have been made alive by God. There can be understanding for lots of other things, but the depravity of the human soul is most clearly seen in the way that the unbeliever tries to relate to God. It is pathetic. Beware of the unregenerate expert. Finally, it is so good to know that God is sovereign and that his will always prevails. I don't know about you, but that gives me phenomenal assurance. For he has called me and I belong to him. Therefore, my destiny is secure.